The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Today, Sunderland in Wonderland as Martin O'Neill debuts with big win over Blackburn Rovers. Elsewhere at the Britannia, more successful throw-in than that Dynamo Zagreb team, as spell is broken for Spurs in Harry V. Potter's drama. And with Bolton going bottom, those are your big stories while we wait for Chelsea Man City. Abroad, there's the Clasico. How was it for you? We compare notes on the game and the biggest pants performance from Ronaldo since that Armani ad. There's Italy, Europa League and much, much more in today's Football Weekly. Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us. On board today, we have Rob Smythe again.
Hello, James.
Hi, Rob. You're jacked up on coffee.
Yes, I am. Apologies for what results from that.
No, I think it's good. I think the enthusiasm is an essential component of today's pod. Michael Cox.
Yeah, I've just got water today.
Why? You don't need anything else, I'm suspecting. Hydration's vital. We like that. And Simon Burnton.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, yeah.
Yeah, you had a busy Sunday.
Yes, I was in this office and watched lots of football.
Great. I know some of the football that you watched involved teams like Stoke, Sunderland, etc., which is great because I wanted to start with Sunderland. The O'Neill miracle cure is underway.
Well, that story continues to be, like, it is still possible to peddle that story because they got the win. Obviously, losing at home to Blackburn would be pretty embarrassing. But for a good half of the match, it looked like they just might. Considerable boos at half-time, which isn't very encouraging for a new manager.
Who were they booing? Was that the Blackburn away fans, perhaps?
No, the Blackburn away fans were at that point cheering a remarkable half-time.
I thought they were being coherent with that no-keen policy by just booing any
well, half-time. I mean, I wasn't at the game, so I guess that's possible. But it certainly sounded...
When you said considerable boos at half-time, I thought you meant O'Neill had been driven to a hip.
Yeah. And quite interesting that James McLean, this Irish winger who made his debut yesterday and is getting quite a lot of credit for the improved performance just in that last quarter of an hour. Well, partly because it's always interesting to see a player. I mean, anyone who reads tabloid transfer tittle-tattle became familiar with his name in the second half of last season. He was linked with lots of English clubs, ended up at Sunderland. Sunderland reserves played Manchester United reserves last week, and that was the first game O'Neill saw, and they won 6-3, and Ryan Noble scored four goals. And Ryan Noble's a young striker who's coming through at Sunderland and not really getting his first-team chance, and a lot of fans are a little bit upset about that. He seems to be a natural goal scorer. But even though he appeared to be the star of that performance last week, O'Neill immediately picked up on McLean, and he's the one who's come into the first team.
That was one of the issues with Steve Bruce, though, that his lack of use of certain key players. And, and would David Vaughan enter into that category and his return another key component in this Sunderland win?
Yeah, quite possibly. Obviously, Casemiro was suspended, so a certain amount of midfield kind of rejigging was enforced.
Vaughan is a fine player. Everyone went on about Charlie Adam last year, but I think Vaughan actually got Supporters Player of the Year at Blackpool.
Ooh.
So, similar player, very good left-footed playmaker.
When he got the equaliser in that match, too early then to talk about an O'Neill effect tactically, although they did have more shots, I noticed, more corners.
Yeah, sorry to jump in straight away with a stat, but they attempted more crosses than any other team in the Premier League for over 18 months, which shows what O'Neill has done already. You know, you look at how he did at Leicester and Celtic and Villa, and it was always players like Steve Guppy and Didier Agat and Ashley Young that he got the best out of. So he does like width, and that shows already. You can't really assess how effective that's been based upon one game that they only won in the last 5 minutes. But, yeah, it was a good performance.
It's very true. A couple of years ago, when I was looking at the chalkboards for Michael, the one thing you noticed is Villa's pattern was incredibly geared towards putting crosses in, not many passes around the middle of the pitch, and a very nice graphic of lots of lines going here.
Mm. He's got Seb Larsson, though. Did you know that no player has scored more times from free kicks in the last 5 seasons than Seb Larsson?
I do now, yeah. Well, that doesn't necessarily surprise me. Right. He's a really good dead ball taker. Mm. Good fantasy league player for those of us who bother with that nonsense.
All right, then.
He seems to get a lot of dip on the free kick, which seems to be increasingly rare, maybe because of the balls. But a lot of people seem to hit the free kick really hard, and struggle to get it come down over the wall. Whereas you look at his run-up, it was really side-on. He really kind of whips it over the wall. I mean, the ball didn't dip into the top corner. It dipped right into the next to the ground, didn't it? Which I think is very impressive from such a short range.
Well, there you go. Less exciting, of course, for Blackburn Rovers, who lose yet again. And amid a major crisis, no, in terms of injuries, another four players having to withdraw for various different ailments, including Gael Givet, who had, what, heart palpitations?
Yeah, it seems it turns out that he has a quite long-running heart problem, that they monitor his heart rate throughout matches, and occasionally it just shoots upwards, and they need to, if and when that happens, they have to pull him off. And that's what happened in the first half yesterday.
That's extraordinary, no?
Yeah.
Yeah, also bad news for Blackburn. Apparently, the banks want them to stick more money into their account, otherwise they might not be able to use it anymore. £10 million, the figure, which does suggest that they, if that's the kind of financial conditions they're operating it in, they might not be going out and splashing too much money around in January. Do they need to? Have they got a full-blown fallback crisis going on at the back?
It looks like it, yeah, and they don't have sufficient squad depth to really cope with that.
Hmm. All right, that's a bit bleak for Blackburn. But they were leading for most of the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, but... All right.
I've only done a few Blackburn games this year, so it might just be kind of coincidence. But when I've seen them, I don't think they're that bad. You can see what the problems are, that they're a bit kind of ragged, but they've got some decent players, particularly going forward.
Did they invite this result by sitting back too much and defending their lead?
The injuries did harm them in the fact that they couldn't make subs late on and give fresh energy to the side, which would have hampered them.
But would that be the charge against Steve Keane, that he basically didn't take advantage of a dominant position in the game?
I think that Keane is working with very limited resources, and he's got a lot personally, individually, still to prove as well, whether he'll really get a chance to, I don't know. I don't think that Martin O'Neill, he's already implemented some tactical changes, but it didn't feel that there was a particularly convincing performance from Sunderland up until they scored that first goal.
Early days, of course. Meantime, elsewhere in the Premier League on Sunday, a terrific match at the Britannia Stadium, which, as you say, you were doing the minute by minutes for.
Yeah, I mean, it was an entertaining match. It started, as Stoke often do, with a bewilderingly fast-paced opening quarter of an hour, in which they scored a goal. And for that first quarter of an hour, Spurs looked totally out of their depth, utterly unable to cope. But of course, Stoke couldn't sustain that pace.
What was it that they were unable to cope with?
They had no time on the ball. Their defence was under constant pressure.
Right.
And with long throws, with set pieces, with just getting the ball into attack as soon as possible.
Yeah.
And Ryan Shotton...
And his hand towel.
And his integral ball drying implement. For those who didn't watch the game, they're not allowed to use towels anymore to dry the ball before the long throws. And Shotton had what appeared to be an integral bib under his shirt that I saw on his Twitter feed this morning, that he explained what it was. Just to clear things up, I wore a vest under my shirt yesterday. Our lovely kit lady cut the back out so it was easier to wipe the wool. So that's Anyway, I don't think that his long throws were quite up to Delap's standards.
Did you not think? I thought they were quite impressive.
They were impressive, but Delap's are genuinely phenomenal. And I've watched Stoke for the last... I mean, since they got promoted, thinking, this is a really interesting tactic, but Delap is old. Eventually he'll retire and they'll have to find a new one. It looks like he is old and he will retire, but they don't need a new tactic.
They've got Shotton.
They do have Shotton.
I had a couple of questions about this. I did enjoy the Stoke fans singing Swing Low Sweet Chariot, a rugby song. Presumably a conscious irony in there.
Yeah.
Right. Second one is... now Stoke, they've beaten Liverpool at the Britannia and they've drawn with Chelsea and Man United. And yet... A succession of lesser-ish teams have gone there and come away with results, leading to the impression of late that Britannia wasn't such a stronghold. Is it just that there's something about playing the big teams that suits the Tony Pulis game plan?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, big teams are generally comprised of quite skillful, technical, often small players, whereas some of those struggling at the bottom of the league have got more old-fashioned British players who are comfortable with challenging for aerial balls and heading it.
Right, so in conventional parlance, big teams don't like it up them in a way that perhaps small teams...
To a certain extent, although I'm not sure that Stoke's home record is as impressive as is often assumed.
No, well, that's of late it really hasn't been.
Yeah.
But and indeed, their performance yesterday, before we get too overexcited, they played brilliantly well in that first quarter of an hour. But Spurs will have had plenty of reason to complain about losing that game.
Right, well, that was my next question. Is Spurs... magic run over, or is it just a Chris Foy-inspired blip?
Neither.
Chris Foy being the referee who...
Stoke aren't as good as you might necessarily read into that result, and Spurs aren't as bad. Spurs, Tottenham's recent run of form has been phenomenal, and we didn't see them play that well yesterday. Bale looked okay. Lennon, a bit out of sorts in the first half, despite switching wings. And then off at half-time. Van der Vaart was invisible for the entire game till he came off late on. Adebayor... had his good moments.
Well, one of which was a goal that was wrongly disallowed. I mean,
wrongly
that was the
disallowed,
thing.
Yeah.
How much did Chris Foy influence this result?
Or is well, that... I think that he has to bear some responsibility for it. I think he got a lot of calls wrong. Modric is the penalty that he did award. I think that wasn't a terrible decision, but for my mind, shouldn't have been given. There was a handball that could have been given just before that disallowed goal.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were plenty of decisions.
Given the handball on the line, on the line, penalty, presumably 2-2. Tottenham would have won that game, the way the momentum was going.
Did it change your view of their prospects for the season at all?
Spurs?
Fight? Yeah.
No, not really. It's the kind of game they're all... It's a bit of a cliche, but it's the kind of game Spurs are always capable of losing. And yet, the way they played at 2-0 down suggested that maybe there's a little bit more resilience than there was, say, 5, maybe even 3 years ago.
Mm.
I didn't think they could win the league before yesterday. I don't think they can, but I think you'd still back them to get in the top four.
One remarkable thing about the game at the Britannia was that Harry Redknapp actually criticised the referee.
Does ordinarily.
It's the first time he's ever done that.
Yeah, in 30-odd years.
Right.
Yeah.
I have to say, I can't remember him criticising referees, but just because I don't keep a mental note of...
It's the same way he says he's, you know, really admires a player, but isn't saying anything about the player.
Right. Well, elsewhere in the Premier League, hey, Newcastle, speak about runs ending. Bottom is dropping out of the Newcastle season. Defeat there at Norwich. After only 8 goals in their first 11 games, they've conceded 7 in their last 2. Poor old Newcastle. Is this anything to do with them losing both first-choice centre-backs?
Really obvious tactic from Paul Lambert. He played Holt and Morrison up front together, which I think he's only done 2 times before this. And all their goals came from set pieces or crosses. They were just constantly hanging balls up into the area. And, I mean, Newcastle playing Danny Simpson at the back, who, according to Wikipedia, which is my usual source, is only 5'8". So you don't want to play like that at centre-back.
You say that like there's not very much, and yet... Anyway, there you go. Norwich, nice to see them getting a win, because it hasn't been the best of runs for them.
Yeah, and they're up into 10th now. They're doing really well. In fact, all the newly promoted clubs are doing pretty well. 10th, 11th and 13th at the moment, which is good to see because it means that the standard at the bottom is more competitive, and some sides like, you know, Wigan and Wolves, who I think would be safe had we had a couple of strugglers coming up, are really being forced to fight for their lives.
Mm. QPR became the first newly promoted team this season to go to Anfield and not get a result. Quick word on Suarez, scoring a goal. Extraordinary.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I know he's a talented player, but you know, he's not someone who finishes a lot of chances.
No, which is odd because in Holland he had a really prolific record, I think.
Yeah.
But we said about this last week, he's a kind of player, he's incredibly effective, but he kind of hasn't taken that last step. But that happens a lot with even established foreign players who come to England. Often it takes a season of adjustment. I think Pires is a really good example.
The funny thing was, when he first arrived, he was banging them in all over.
Yeah, true. Mm. So maybe I'm just talking nonsense.
No, just one of those things. It could be just one of those things, because you have your Rooney as well. He wasn't scoring either. Look at him now. 2.
Mm. Yeah, it's quite like that difficult last step. I mean, Cristiano Ronaldo was another example. Played really well for 3 years, but in terms of actually kind of sheer efficiency of goals and assists, it took him 3 years to develop. Pires took a season, and the second season he was Player of the Year. So I think Suarez will be okay.
All right, then.
It would help, obviously. The players around him are influential up to a point.
Well, that's true. Man United, anyway, with a big win over Wolves, which I'm sure came in very handy. What else happened? Arsenal, they had all their old players parading around, the Invincibles and all that, and they celebrated with a traditional 1-0 win, which was very sweet. And a great goal, of course, from Robin van Persie.
Wonderful goal.
Wonderful goal.
Wonderful. I mean, just every time I see it, I like it more. I mean, it's one of those... If you... watch much of the day on Sky Plus, as I did. It's one of those ones where you stop and just have another look.
Yeah. Although, this will get me into trouble, but I actually prefer Danny Graham's goal for Swansea against Fulham. There was something about it that, what? How did he do that?
Because the corner was so low as well.
Yeah.
There was no one marking that near post zone, was there?
And he was well marked. I don't know who was on him, but he was basically...
Was it Hangeland, maybe?
It might have been, yeah. And he managed to nip his foot round, turn the ball in, and then nip his foot back out again without really seeming to ever kind of lose his... It was quite Matrix-esque, I suppose, in that. I got quite excited. But obviously, Robin van Persie was a thing of beauty. That was a good win for Swansea, wasn't it? Although no great surprise to see them winning at home to Fulham. And Bolton are now last after Villa got the victory there at the Reebok. Boos again at the Reebok. We were talking about fans booing and that. How difficult is the situation now for Owen Coyle?
Well, they're bottom of the table now.
Obviously.
Aston Villa's away record is poor. And yet they scored twice and missed 4-5 very clear chances. And it could have been a very humiliating result, that.
I can't make sense what's happening with Bolton because they look so good for a year and a half under Coyle. I know they've got some players missing, but they're a complete rabble at the moment. I think they're in big trouble, and it's weird. I mean, 6 months ago I'd have said he was arguably Britain's brightest young manager, but I think he'll be gone within a couple of months.
Extraordinary, isn't it? There doesn't seem to be that fight.
I haven't
fight
seen him enough, but it's difficult to make sense of it, to be honest.
Can you make sense of it, Mike?
I don't think they've ever been a particularly good team.
Oh, really?
They had a couple of good results about this stage last year, but they tailed off really badly towards the end of last season. They did lose a couple of players, and we shouldn't forget that Holden and Lee are massive losses.
Yeah.
And if you're a side in the bottom five, bottom six, you just can't cope with losing two of your best players. So I do feel sorry for him in that respect.
All right, then. Well, that's it for part one. More to come as right after this we dial up Sid Lowe in Spain. Sid Lowe in Spain.
Hello, James. How are you?
I'm very well. You sound chipper today, Sid.
I'm feeling all right, yeah.
Good, good. Is that Johnny Cash I can hear playing in the background?
You know it is, Jimbo.
Hey! What track's that, then?
Which track was that? Oh, it was The Man Comes Around.
Oh, right, yeah, there you go. Now, that probably links in quite well, you know, with Mourinho and Pep Guardiola and the Pep Show Boys, as one Argentine paper dubbed Barcelona after Saturday night's Clásico, a game we all watched and enjoyed this weekend. Sid, so many questions. Let's start with the press reaction, shall we, to Real Madrid and this latest defeat against their rivals?
As have done, I think, a really quite a good job today of analysing what went wrong, of Cristiano Ronaldo's consistent problems in the Clásico against Barcelona. Their front cover says Cristiano Ronaldo always breaks down against Barca.
Well, I saw the reaction I think everyone heard to, or it certainly seemed to be a very negative reaction to Ronaldo and his performance from the fans. And was it Marca running a poll where viewers had been asked to give votes to, you know, their ratings to the various players? And he came out with, I think, 1.8 out of 10 or something?
Yeah, no, that's the fans. I think that's partly a product of the you know, the kind of the immediate irritation of losing. Although it's interesting that one of the kind of more aggressive Madrid supporting columnists in El Mundo, which is a normal newspaper rather than a sports one, was talking about how it no longer hurts. We've seen this so often now that we just get beaten and it doesn't hurt. I think that's not true. I also think there's no doubt at all that Cristiano Ronaldo's record in the bigger games against Barcelona is not as good. I mean, the stats on the front of ours, you know, he's played 10 Clásicos and won one of them. He's scoring a goal every 301 minutes instead of his normal record of every 90 minutes. But I think the desire to kind of blame him individually, I think, is pretty harsh, even though he missed two very good chances. And I think there is almost a kind of a facileness, if there is such a word as facileness, about the way people are going purely for Cristiano Ronaldo.
They started out with terrific self-belief, Real Madrid. They seem to think they could beat Barcelona. Barcelona seemed to think Real Madrid could beat Barcelona. And then, what, sort of half an hour? It was almost as if they kind of woke up to find themselves standing on stage in their underpants, if you know what I mean, the Real Madrid,
yeah,
the kind of reality bit.
That's not a bad way of looking at it. And also, not just... I would go so far as to say they woke up on half an hour standing on stage in their underpants and Leo Messi was standing there saying, boys, you're in your underpants. Leo Messi went and got the ball, picked it up very deep off Gerard Piqué, which tells you about how deep he'd gone to get it, carry the ball up the pitch and created a goal out of almost nothing. Now, I think that view is ever so slightly skewed because, of course, you know, during the heat of the game, and you sometimes don't always see things developing. And I would say that Barcelona had actually started to get hold of the ball before that 30th minute goal. And bear in mind as well that it was in the sixth or the seventh minute, I can't remember now, where Messi nearly scored the equaliser himself, doing exactly the same thing, getting the ball, winning it off Ramos in this case, dashing through three or four players and getting the save from Kassir. So I think Barcelona's reaction was good. And this is what I'm writing about today for the site. It's about Barcelona's nerve, that you've really got to admire them. That Victor Valdes gets caught out. He gives away a goal that could be absolutely colossal. So what does he do the next time the ball comes to him? He plays it out again. He doesn't hoof it long. He doesn't try and say, oh my God, I'm terrified, get rid of it. He keeps on trying to play. And I think one of the key reasons why Barcelona are so good is that they have a very, very clear identity and there's real conviction in the way they play. Now, occasionally that's problematic, of course, because occasionally it means they maybe don't have certain bits of variety that you might like in a game. Occasionally they make the same mistake, but they basically make that same mistake because they take a decision that our identity is what it is, and therefore we will keep trying to do that.
Right.
As said, I was just wondering whether Guardiola gave any specific reason for what I thought was quite a crucial tactical switch after about 20 minutes when he moved Alves forward, moved Puyol to the right, and then it was kind of Puyol and Piqué almost doubling up against Ronaldo. Was that the reason or was it something else?
No, well, Guardiola was very interesting on this. He'd said in the build-up to the game that he recognised that three at the back against Real Madrid was very, very risky, but that it provided other alternatives and enabled him to flood the midfield. And I think Guardiola was one of these coaches that if he possibly could, he'd play an entire team of midfielders because he sees the game as hinging on the ability to control possession of the ball and control possession of the ball in those key areas, which he believes is the middle of the pitch. But he said after the game that change was a change that he'd always planned to do, to start with four at the back, but move Alves up. And then everything shifts. So Alves moves up, as you say. Puyol comes across ever so slightly. And in defensive phases of the game, Busquets drops in between the two centre-backs. And when they've got the ball, Busquets steps out from the two centre-backs. Guardiola afterwards said that he'd always planned to do that. And in fact, that he was planning to do it after 3 or 4 minutes, you know, just to start like that, make Madrid believe that they have a certain shape and then switch to the other shape. But that because they conceded the goal, he wanted a certain degree of stability. So he actually held off making that change rather than doing it immediately.
Sid, we've got a fire alarm going on here, so I'm just going to ask you one more question and then sadly we'll have to vacate.
Socorro, me estoy quemando.
Yeah, exactly. Very much the mood here. For Mourinho then, a terrific run of games. He seemed to really have got this Real Madrid playing some of the best football around. And yet when it comes to the big appointment, again, he comes up short, and there really didn't seem to be any excuses this time. How damaging is this for him, or is it just accepted now that Barcelona are going to win the Clásicos?
It's a very good question, and I must confess I don't know yet what kind of emotional damage this will do. But it's he after the game was trying to be very calm. He talked about luck, which I thought was a pretty weak excuse, and obviously an excuse that he never used when his teams were winning things. But you know, I suppose if you look at isolated incidents, you could say the second Barcelona goal was very fortunate. Cristiano Ronaldo missed a very, very good chance at 1-0, which would have made it 2-0. And who knows if it had been different. But the sensation is of a Barcelona team that was just far, far superior. I personally think we're in a bizarre situation now where Madrid could still win the league despite losing once or possibly even twice to Barcelona, despite not feeling like they're as good as them because, of course, the rest of the teams are weak enough that Madrid will keep on winning. I think this does do a bit of damage to Mourinho. It also brings some of those very small tensions under the surface, perhaps closer to the surface, and maybe means that they blow up again. And one of the things that I stressed in when I was talking about Mourinho before this game and everything that he's got right, some of what he's got right was imposed upon him by players who said to him, you cannot go on doing what you're doing. You cannot keep moaning about referees, creating tension, creating an environment which is uncomfortable for us. And not only that, but the relationship between him and some of the players is not quite as good as it's always been portrayed to be. But he temporarily at least created a kind of degree of union. But that union is always relatively precarious. I must admit, I think this is damaging for them. But the question is, do they just carry on winning now until the next Clásico? There's another thing that's really significant here that's been forgotten, I think. Coming to 5-0 last year, Madrid were playing really well. And
Sid,
the one that's really been forgotten
Sid,
is...
sorry,
coming,
no.
Yeah.
The building is apparently on fire and not in the Leo Messi scoring streak sense either. So we really sadly have to leave that there. We'll get more on Thursday and, of course, a bumper press review coming up on Friday. But thanks for the moment, Sid.
OK, we'll talk about the burning issues then.
Hey, cheers, Sid. Well, listeners, the exciting news is that fire alarm is now over and we can proceed with today's Football Weekly. So much more to discuss, he said, looking for things still to discuss. Well, Chelsea Man City coming up later today, of course. So for a lot of you, that will already have happened. A huge game. Huge. And so many interesting stories regarding Chelsea coming into this one. This business that Villas-Boas supposedly, or somebody from Chelsea saying that he had demanded that players celebrate their goals with him. And Chelsea then issuing a denial of this. So he hasn't actually come out and said this, but he's certainly taken a lot of stick for it. It does seem a bit inexplicable as managerial demands go.
It does, yeah. I think what they're claiming now is that he said the players should look over to the bench and he would see the staff celebrating, which is quite nice. But, I mean, it depends entirely on the tone he said this with, yeah, doesn't it?
Certainly does. What might be interesting is the notion that somebody, therefore, in Chelsea is kind of briefing against him, no? If this was...
Well, that has supposedly led to the news today that he's shut the reserve side out of the training ground. Have you heard this?
Yes.
Because he's worried about leaks in that respect.
Right.
And I think Kalou... Is it Kalou and Alex who are due to go?
Anelka and Alex.
Yeah.
Anelka who's going to Shanghai, apparently, excitingly enough.
Yeah, apparently they've been told that they're not allowed to train with the first team anymore.
Well, this is very much the case now, Chelsea. All very interesting, but as we say, that game to be played this evening and, well...
He's starting to come across as a bit of a... cross between a kind of mini Mourinho ticking all the boxes and a bit of David Brent as well.
Do you think?
Well, I thought he was really impressive at first, and I think his grievance about the press is legitimate up to a point, but I think he's going too far now in a lot of things. His thing about Gary Neville was a bit... He either willfully took a quote out of context or misunderstood it, and the celebration thing is preposterous. I mean, it's not... I just don't think it happened. I mean, you see with Mourinho... Everything feels natural, even when it is contrived, it feels like he knows exactly what he's doing. I just think Villas-Boas has started ticking boxes now, which is a bit worrying.
Mm. All right. That game to come. Also coming up in the next few days, top Europa League action. Stoke already through, and they're playing Besiktas. Spurs are at Shamrock Rovers. To qualify, they must win in Dublin, hope that Rubin Kazan lose and make up a goal difference deficit, which currently stands at 5, because it would be disastrous if they didn't stay in that competition for Spurs. Of course. Europa League is extraordinary, isn't it? We did kind of mention this last week. All these games being played, and then Man United, Man City et al. Come in, and it completely...
It's preposterous. It reflects... Preposterous. Football has an increase in kind of culture of the second chance, and then the third chance, and the fourth chance, and the fifth chance. And that's just not the way cup competition should be, obviously. Their nature is to be a knockout. It's such a shame, because it was a fantastic tournament when it was UEFA Cup. So was the Cup Winners' Cup. The balance was perfect. And I thought Platini's comments... slagging Ferguson off were a bit rich, given that he's part of an organisation that completely jiggered the UEFA Cup anyway. So then he moaned about Ferguson saying it was a penalty.
Mm. Good to see someone having a go at Ferguson, though. Here's Mittier Person saying the Basel result came down with, going back to the issue of the Basel defeat for Man United, it came down to mismanagement rather than lack of funds. A lot of people commenting on the topics raised in our last show about how much of an influence the money that the Glazers have taken out has on... United's current predicament and recent disappointments in Europe. But a lot of people as well saying that it's extraordinary the extent to which Ferguson has escaped without any of the blame.
For the Glazers' mismanagement?
No, you I know make that point, Rob, but secondly for what happened in Basel.
Yeah, up to a point. I'm not sure there's much more he could have done, really. Carrick was suspended, which was a huge blow, so he had to make do, as always.
You were talking about an air of complacency last week. Isn't that down to the management?
It is if there was one. I mean, that's just, we don't know that. I think there was a certain sense of, yeah, now we've got the measure of this, like we won't underestimate them again. But I'm still not sure Ferguson could have done that much more. I mean, okay, he's got a problem now where when there's a problem creatively, he solves it by just throwing on centre-forwards. So he's sent on Welbeck and Makeda rather than fixing the route. Like last season at Arsenal, they ended up with 4 centre-forwards, I think, and a midfield of Park and Carrick or something. So it was completely unbalanced. But generally, I'm not sure with the available players, I'm not sure what else he could have done, really.
Tactically, has he not just been consistently found out in Europe over his career?
I wouldn't go that far. I think there are times when he's got it spot on. I remember Porto away, Inter away, when he dropped Rooney and United were absolutely brilliant and should have won. There are times, I mean, everyone says the 99 final. But again, I'm not sure what he could have done there with the players unavailable. I don't think he's as weak as people say tactically, but equally, I don't think he's as good as he thinks he is.
Michael, your view?
Well, I think he had a spell of being very, very good tactically when they won it, when they got to the final against Barcelona, even though he made a couple of mistakes. Last few years, I think he's been a little bit questionable. I remember, 3 seasons away at Bayern Munich when they were 1-0 up, he took off Carrick and brought on Berbatov, and that kind of conceded the midfield ground, and United conceded too late on. But I'm not sure against Basel it was a particularly tactical thing. I think they were slightly unlucky in that game. And it wasn't just about the Basel game as well. I mean, it was a group situation. They didn't win their home games, which you've got to do to progress in Europe.
Interesting. Simon, do you have a view on that?
I think the questions can be asked about him. And
do you think he gets an easy ride? Let me ask you that. Do you think he gets an easier ride because he's Sir Alex Ferguson than other managers do?
I think he deserves an easier ride because he's Sir Alex Ferguson. I mean, you don't, seasons don't exist in isolation. And his success over the last 20 years, 25, 30 years, as a manager is phenomenal. He deserves to have the credit for that, always. But at the same time, Manchester United weren't brilliant in winning the league last season, started the season excellently. But there are questions that should be asked about him and his future, and given his age...
Is there any plan in place for a replacement, Rob?
I suspect that, given the Glazers' kind of commitment to results and obviously the money that brings, I'm sure Mourinho is streets ahead of everyone else. But I think there's opposition to that within the club, from certain people who kind of think that Mourinho isn't a United manager in terms of the way he conducts himself and the perception of the way his teams play, even if that doesn't always match the reality. One area I think Ferguson does get an easy ride is rotation. He's named two unchanged sides in 3.5 seasons. Now, if Benitez did that, he'd be slaughtered. Ferguson was called, actually, long before the Tinkerman Ranieri, he was known as Tinkerbell because he couldn't help fiddling. For example, he left Mark Hughes out of a title decider. And in a way, I think he's very good with rotation up to a point. He apparently never reckons he plans 10 games ahead. But maybe he's a little bit too flexible at times and that doesn't allow players to get a rhythm.
Hitman Hearn says, oh, here's something the pod may wish to discuss on a quiet day when you just had a fire alarm. Which current managers in the Premier League, but around Europe as well, I guess, were much better players than all of the players they manage? I came up with Dalglish, says Hitman Hearn. Dalglish, is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. Suarez is obviously superb, but I'd say Dalglish slightly above. We were just chatting about it. Paul Lambert as well, I would say.
Really? Yeah.
An excellent player. Maybe Mancini.
I'm going with Mancini on this, yeah.
Yeah, Mancini, Silva, that's quite tight.
Well, I think if you look at the length of Mancini's career, although, as you were saying, in for example, in England, he's not as recognised. Mm. Certainly in Italy, he was regarded as gifted as Badger.
One thing that's interesting, just looking at the Premier League, is how few great players are in charge, or even very good players. There's a lot of, and that obviously Wenger and Mourinho come from, and Villas-Boas come from a not much of a playing background. Mm. I don't know if something's changing there.
Right. You got any top managers managing players who are not as good as them?
No, I was thinking around Europe and a lot of people like our Valencia manager Unai Emery. Mourinho obviously didn't have a great playing career. In Germany, a lot of those managers are kind of quite young who've gone through the got their coaching badges, a little bit like Lambert, who's almost a German product rather than a British product. So, no, interesting to see if that's changed over the last 10 years.
Ali McCoist.
There you go.
Paolo Di Canio.
It's extraordinary. There isn't one out there. No, that's all there is. Okay, fine.
Klinsmann, I know he's not in.
That's the thing, the really great ones, they struggle to manage, don't they?
Mm. Yeah, even...
Ancelotti, that's a great one.
Yeah.
But was he better than... I mean, he did a fantastic job, but was he...
What about Leonardo when he was coach of Milan and Inter? Would you place him above their current crop?
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting that he... As I recall, at Milan, certainly he wasn't a starter. He used to come on to deadly effect, but he wasn't a game-changing... I mean, he was a game-changing sub, but he wasn't, you know, a player that you've built a team around.
That great generation of players haven't done that much managing, have they? Van Basten. Nope. I know Rijkaard won a European Cup, but, yeah. Mateus, Klinsmann, Viali. Mancini's doing okay.
Yeah.
But that kind of Serie A generation hasn't done
There's
that
There's probably
much.
One really huge example we're forgetting. No doubt someone will refresh our memories very, very shortly. All right, well, listen, one other thing then before we hang up our headphones for the day. Lots of other Europa League games and some big must-win matches. Michael, you were just talking about Fulham. And they are in a good... they're in the driving seat in their group for qualification, the Cottagers, Michael. Did you know the story or not? They're taking on Odense, but they're a point ahead of their rivals, Wisla, so they just basically need to win and then...
Where are Twente?
Twente have won the group and they're... Okay. Yeah. And Odense, who are taking on Fulham, are already out. So, yeah, it could be Fulham through to the knockout stages again. Fantastic. They're not the only English side, of course. You've got Birmingham City, are third in their group behind Bruges and Braga. But if they win against the already eliminated Maribor, they'll go through to the knockout stages instead of Bruges because they've got a better head-to-head record, apparently. Yeah. Anyway, I think that's if Bruges lose against Braga. It's all very complicated. I'm looking forward to Thursday when all the...
Very exciting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Remember when European football was the absolute pinnacle? As a kid, you'd hear it through a crackly radio. It was the most exciting thing in the world. Now you've got teams who pretty much would never say it, but they want to go out.
Right.
What a farce.
What a farce indeed.
What a business.
Yeah.
So we could actually end up with six teams in the Europa League from Britain.
Yeah.
From England, rather.
Five Premier League teams. That would mean about one 3 p.m. kickoff every
Saturday. Even a Scottish team. Udinese Calcio hosting Celtic. Celtic are currently 3 points ahead. Oh, sorry, behind Udinese. So, etc. But a very interesting game there as well.
And in fact, England was the only league that started with 8 teams in Europe, and none of them would have been knocked out. So probably would be good for our coefficient points. Not that we need them.
Not that you need them. No. All right, then. Udinese are currently top of Serie A, of course, after their exciting win at the weekend over Chievo. But that's because Juve have yet to play this weekend. It's a big Monday night clash for them. They are at Roma, where situation is, shall we say, delicate for coach Luis Enrique. I think a lot of people there are enjoying his project, but how much time do you give it?
Could be one of the last times we see Totti and Del Piero on a pitch together.
Well, that's very true. The chances of them actually both being on the pitch.
Quite slim, yeah.
Fairly slim, you'd say. But, should be a cracking fixture, that. That's on Monday night. We'll be looking back on that on Thursday when we do Football Weekly Extra. In the meantime, many thanks of you all for joining us today. Rob Smythe, Michael Cox, Simon Burton, and guest producer Matt Hill. Have a super couple of days until we're back with you. And from all of us here in the meantime, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.